This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with a leading expert in whistleblower rights about a recent Supreme Court decision that removes key pieces from our First Amendment protections.
The Supreme Court, the executive, and possibly Congress are trying to make sure that we can't learn the truth. Even people on the inside who want to come out and tell us about the evils of this government are being told, you do it, you're fired, you may go to jail.
Torture of innocent civilians in Chicago.
Torture is not just occurring at Guantanamo and Bagram in Iraq. It's homegrown, it's here, it's in Chicago, and it's in our prisons throughout the United States.
Today, Ed Jackson, internationally recognized expert on tasers, joins us to talk about the new Amnesty International report.
Tasers, electric shock, hear what they do to people and how they're misused.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
The Supreme Court recently struck a blow to whistleblower rights in this country. In deciding the case of Garcetti v. Ceballos, the court removed key pieces from the Whistleblower Protection Act of 1986. The decision effectively curtails First Amendment protection for government whistleblowers. Since the court ruled that the First Amendment protections do not extend to government employees for comments made while performing their official duties, even when the employee is acting to expose alleged government wrongdoing. Joining us today is Stephen Cohn, chairman of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C. Stephen, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you.
Stephen, before we get your analysis of the recent Supreme Court decision in Garcetti v. Ceballos, can you please, for our listeners, just outline the facts of the case?
Facts are the same beat as the space shuttle engineers when they saw engineering problems before the space shuttle blew up. If it was Colleen Raleigh at the FBI seeing that they weren't granting a FISA to someone who would be a terrorist. If it's even, say, Sharon Watkins, who's seeing that there are financial irregularities and they need to be reported. It's a very typical scenario. Nothing in the case was out of the ordinary for what is, in fact, standard whistleblowing.
The specific facts of this case, isn't it something like there was a federal prosecutor and he believed that sheriffs had lied to get a search warrant?
Exactly.
And he testified, he wrote an internal memo, he went to a public hearing, he testified for the defense in court. This is exactly the kind of truth-telling that we need.
In the area of law enforcement, and this decision really takes a smack at any police whistleblowers, because when it says performing your official duties, you're not protected, policemen are required to uphold the law. So when this person who was in a law enforcement capacity believed there was a violation of law, i.e. false information in a search warrant, he's been disciplined. Any police officer that would say witnessed abuse in a prison, witnessed a false arrest, witnessed bad laboratory work, they're all at risk now.
Steve, how does the affect the Whistleblower Protection Act of 1986?
Okay, the Whistleblower Protection Act concerning federal employees is a lousy law. But what this law does, with this interpretation, it takes away constitutional First Amendment protections. everyone always looked at the First Amendment as the floor. You could have a good statute or a bad statute, but the First Amendment protected speech of public concern, which was always viewed as whistleblower speech. Now, that's been pulled out. So the WPA, which is not the strongest law, is what federal employees will have now.
Mm-hmm. Not much protection.
Not much at all.
You know what struck me, Stephen? I heard Daniel Ellsberg interviewed a couple of weeks ago, and he's been encouraging government people. Daniel Ellsberg was the person that revealed the Pentagon Papers case, which spilled the beans on the corruption and cynicism of the war in Vietnam. Even as they were prosecuting it, they knew they couldn't win it. He was prosecuted for that. He stepped forward, and he's encouraging other people to do the same thing with respect to what's going on in Iraq now, really almost in response to his campaign. I think he's trying to raise funds for these people. He's trying to protect them if they come forward. And there are people in the government that want to do the right thing. They've been coming forward since Iraq. Stephen, I wanted your thoughts on that in the context of what Ellsberg is trying to do. What does this Supreme Court decision do to us?
This decision doesn't hurt people who go to the press. And it's like a paradox. Most whistleblowers go through their chain of command. They will be the real victims here. If you go to the press, you're still protected under the First Amendment. Now, some people sit back and say that's great, but in reality, it means about 90% of whistleblowers will be not unprotected because it's the rare individual that has the courage to go to the press, at least initially. Sometimes it may take a year or two. And let me just give you an example. We represent Bunny Greenhouse, the Army Corps of Engineers heroine who exposed improprieties of the no-bid contracts given to Halliburton. She was the highest-ranking contracts official in the Army Corps, and she objected to those contracts. When she objected internally and wrote "object" on the contracting document, under this Supreme Court case, she could have been fired. Thereafter, we wrote a letter to Congress on her behalf. About a year later, that letter to Congress would be protected. But had this decision been in place when Bunny Greenhouse first blew the whistle, the moment she did her objection, they could have shown her the door. And that's what you're going to see. Corrupt politicians, officials with something to hide, will read this decision essentially as their Bill of Rights. Get rid of the whistleblower before they have, you know, the frustration or the audacity to go to the press. And that's where it's going to be on the grassroots level. It's going to be have a terrible impact. We argued this whole issue back in the 80s in the atomic energy industry. And you had the industry, the atomic energy industry, saying, oh, all the workers should go to the NRC and blow the whistle to the NRC, not to their managers. And you had the NRC and the Ronald Reagan Justice Department saying no. If they don't protect them through the chain of command or doing their official duties, the whistleblower laws will be destroyed. We won that argument. Now the Bush administration has reversed it.
Stephen, in your experience, when an employee goes directly to the press, and hopefully that will start happening in larger numbers now after this legislation, but in your experience, is there retaliation from the employer?
Oh, absolutely. Every time an employee engages in protected activity, if an employer has something to hide, there will be retaliation.
And that's what happened in the case that went up to the Supreme Court. What happened to him? Was he demoted, fired?
He was removed from his job.
It's a very strange standard to set up, that when you see that there is something wrong internally, that you're not protected if you go to your manager and say, hey, there's something really wrong going on here. I think we ought to fix it. But you are protected if you just go to the press or go to the public.
Exactly. It's a bonehead decision for that reason, but it's insidious because the Bush Solicitor's Office, which advocated this, and employers who have advocated it in the past, they know that 90% of the whistleblowers start out as loyal, honest, hardworking civil servants who report through the chain of command. If they're able to fire you based upon chain of command reporting, they will win 90% of the cases. So although it may seem strange that any government official would want to encourage someone to go to the press, it's actually a hollow statement, because they can get you before you do. That's the danger of this decision. On a practical level, it will have a chilling effect on anyone's willingness to make a disclosure. That said, because whistleblowing is still protected if you go to the press, if someone comes to an organization like the National Whistleblower Center or attorneys that understand this area of the law, they will be able to have them blow the whistle in a way they'll be legally protected. But I'd say that will be 1 in 100 or 1 in 10.
Saying that, well, you can go to the press is really a cold comfort, particularly given the nature of our corporate centralized media.
Yeah.
What's so scary to me and Heidi and Dahlia about this decision was that this kind of government secrecy, coupled with the media and coupled with the propaganda that more and more comes out of the media and the massive spying on our citizens, you couple them all together and it's just really a giant step towards a police state, isn't it?
Well, any time you squelch dissent among people who see the problems, direct, first-hand witnesses, you're talking about totalitarianism. But I want to say what's worse about this decision. It is a throwback to the case law of 100 years ago. This is the first time that I know, and I could be corrected on this, that the Supreme Court, in 100 years or 50 years, has said speech of public concern can be suppressed. And that's what's startling. If you take, say, the flag burning case, they found enough public concern in burning a flag in terms of an expression of free speech to protect it. But now they've come right around, and what they're saying is even if it's of public concern that usually gets the most support under the First Amendment, you can still be legally retaliated against.
What's the rationale behind this decision?
The rationale behind it is they radically altered First Amendment analysis. Instead of looking at whether the speech is of public concern, they're looking at who the audience is. They haven't done that before. If someone was, say, was marching down the street and there was only one person witnessing the march, they still were protected. Or even if no one showed up to witness the march, they're still protected. No one ever looked at who is the audience. The issue has always been, is there an element of public concern? This is the first time, and there's no rationale to that. And this radically changed the First Amendment law in the workplace that was developed in 1968, in which the primary issue the Supreme Court identified was, is it speech of public concern? If it is, we'll protect it. That doesn't mean if you were insubordinate or you did something outrageous on the job, you couldn't be fired for insubordination or for tardiness or for coming in drunk, but you couldn't be fired for speech that was a matter of public concern. The Supreme Court's change of that standard is radical, and that is what, if you look at this, in terms of broader trends, this has not happened in years. And in fact, George Will, who wrote a column supporting the decision, went back to an 1890s. First Amendment case of the U.S. Supreme Court when they didn't protect First Amendment speech like we do over the last 60 years, and said essentially that decision from the 1890s has been brought back to life.
Stephen, how is this going to affect the work of the center from now forward? And do you do lobbying or is it mostly direct representation?
We will be pushing, you know, within the confines of what we're allowed to do as a tax-exempt organization, a Whistleblower Protection Act, which actually will solve the problem. And we've been urging it as a matter of public policy for years. There is no good national whistleblower protection law.
So you'll try to get Congress to correct what the Supreme Court just did?
And I think we have a strong chance on doing that. For example, in the Sarbanes-Oxley corporate whistleblower law, which we worked heavily on, specifically protects reports to managers and through the chain of command. There was a recognition. And so we're going to want essentially the same protections now given to corporate employees to be given to public employees.
If listeners are interested in learning more about the Whistleblower Center's work, where can they go? Is there a website?
Go to whistleblowers.org.
And we'll have that up on our website at lawanddisorder.org. Let me ask you about Alito's role in this, having placed O'Connor. What happened with that switch on the court?
Well, there's no doubt that O'Connor was a pragmatist and a more of a common sense judge. When this issue first was argued in 1971 before a conservative Nixon-appointed judge, he ruled for the whistleblower and said, common sense. And what this decision shows is a radical disregard of common sense being supplanted by a conservative ideology. And that's the danger here. Where was the common sense? And now they have a fifth vote on that.
We look forward to hearing more about the success of the center on this.
And we're really pushing for you in taking this decision and turning it around through Congress. And we're counting on our representatives to really do something about it, because in this era where they are shutting down dissent, where the government, where the administration is putting a clamp on people's legitimate voices, we need to fight back. And this is really important work you're doing. We need to protect people within the government who want to speak out about its misconduct. So thank you, and we hope to have you back with great news.
Thank you very much.
Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Yeah.
That was Stephen Cohn, chairman of the National Whistleblowers Center, joining us on Law and Disorder to talk about the recent Supreme Court case that punishes whistleblowers from within government agencies.
This land is your land.
A United Nations anti-torture panel has urged the United States to punish law enforcement officials who mistreat suspects. The 10-member UN Committee Against Torture reported that the multi-million-dollar investigation into Chicago's alleged torture of well over 200 black men in interrogation during the 70s and 80s has not resulted in any prosecutions. 200 African Americans were tortured by former Commander John Burge and detectives under his command at the Chicago Police Department. Torture techniques ranged from electrically shocking genitalia with cattle prods to suffocation with plastic bags. Here, for an update on this case that we've covered before, is Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office.
Flint, we've heard that there's going to be a follow-up report to the earlier report of the civil rights violations. Do you know when that will be released?
It's one and the same report. The report hasn't been released yet. We've been battling out here for the last 6 or 8 weeks about release of the special prosecutor's report. The cops' lawyers, the state's attorney's lawyers, and are all fighting to keep the report secret, where we and others from the community and activists, the special prosecutor is fighting to have it made public. And also we're fighting over whether the names of the multitude of cops who refused to testify in front of the grand jury and took the Fifth Amendment rather than to talk about the torture, whether those names are going to be revealed. And at this point, the judge ordered it, the report revealed, but one of the parties, one of the state's attorneys, has taken it to the Illinois Supreme Court. So it is hung up on a possible appeal right now, and so the report itself has not been released.
How long has this been dragging out, and what are you afraid of in terms of they're dragging it out even further?
It depends on what you mean by dragging it out. I mean, there's been no prosecutions, no indictments since the 70s when this torture started. There's been no indictments and no prosecutions since 1982 when it was publicly known and specifically given to the state's attorney, Richie Daley, to prosecute for one particularly egregious case of torture, and he chose not to. So it's been dragging out in that sense for many, many, many years. In terms of the report itself, the special prosecutor has been investigating for 4 years. The county has paid him $7.7 million, and apparently he's decided after that all he can do is issue a sharply critical report that he cannot indict anybody because it's too long ago and the statute of limitations is a bar.
Now, in this investigation, wasn't this the first that actually used a grand jury that had subpoena powers?
No question. It's the first time there was a legitimate investigation outside the contours of the many civil cases that we brought on behalf of the victims of police torture. There was one administrative proceeding which fired Burge for one case of torture out of the 192 we now know about. But other than that, yes, this is the first investigation that had the power of the grand jury. We expect that it won't be the last, because if this report has half of what we expect and hope that it will be in it, we have to and will turn to the U.S. attorney and Patrick Fitzgerald, demand that the feds investigate and bring charges under federal RICO statutes and under federal obstruction of justice and federal perjury.
Flint, now that they've got it hung up and going up to the high court in the state of Illinois, how much time can they buy that gimmick?
Anywhere from a week to a couple of months. Right now, it's an extraordinary appeal in the sense that there's no right to appeal from such an order. They have to use the writ of mandamus, and they are attempting to get the Supreme Court to accept the appeal. All the Supreme Court has done has given them the right to brief the question of why they should be able to appeal, and the special prosecutor is opposing their right to appeal. So the Illinois Supreme Court could decide it this week, or it could decide to entertain a full briefing, and then it could be off to the races for several more months.
That's what I was afraid of. For our listeners, we're on the line with Flint Taylor, attorney at the People's Law Office in Chicago, who for three decades has exposed the torture of some, we now know, 200 African-Americans on the south side of Chicago. False confessions, long-term imprisonment, terrible stories, and Flint has flushed this out, and it's now come to a head, and the government is vainly trying to prevent a special report from coming out. And Flint, you said that special report didn't go far enough, and they used the excuse of what you said was a statute of limitations so as to not prosecute the torturers. Can you explain to our audience what the statute of limitations is?
Yes. The statute of limitations for all crimes except murder limits the amount of years that the prosecutor can wait before he indicts you after the crime is committed. There are exceptions to that. Certainly perjury is one. Certainly obstruction of justice, conspiracy to obstruct justice is another. But that's the statute of limitations. There is a movement on in international human rights circles here and other places to have the statute of limitations modified in torture cases. And under international law, I believe that torture, there is no statute of limitations, and that certainly should be what it is in both federal and state law here, but it is not. Recently, the Convention Against Torture's Committee Against Torture in Geneva looked at the Burge cases and issued a very sharply worded report in which it likened Chicago to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and secret prison situations, and very strongly stated that the government should investigate and prosecute the torture here in the city of Chicago.
Flint, what's the rationale behind having a statute of limitations? Wouldn't we want people to always be... Sorry, excuse me. They're laughing here in the studio at me because my voice... I've been sick for a bit, so bear with me. But what can you talk with our listeners a little bit about what the purpose behind a statute of limitations is? Because the average person out there thinks, you know, if someone has done something wrong, we should always be free to bring them to court and bring justice.
Well, maybe some of your co-hosts could help me out with this, but my understanding is making certain in terms of how long it can be before you're charged with a crime. Otherwise, somebody could decide to charge you 30 years later with a crime, and there'd be no witnesses left, and you'd have no way to really defend yourself. So I think as a protection under the Constitution to the rights of defendants and innocent and as well as possibly guilty people, to have some certainty in terms of how long a prosecutor has to prosecute. Otherwise, the prosecutorial power would be unbridled. This is an exception, I would think, in many ways. When you cover up evidence, when you yourself are a government official, when you engage in acts of internationally condemned torture, then the statute of limitations should not apply. It's no different in my mind than the cases in the South where 30, 40 years later they finally got around to investigating and properly charging those who were Klansmen and others who were involved in conspiring to blow up churches and to kill the black children in Birmingham and the other atrocities. The civil rights workers that were murdered. And they prosecuted them. The men were 70 and 80 years old. And I feel that should be what happens here, because there's no real difference between Burge and the kind of torture that he was committing with his men here and the kind of atrocities that we see under extension of slavery and white terror in the South.
Flint, back to the issue of whether the names of the current and former police and prosecutors will be included. The state is arguing that they invoked their Fifth Amendment right when they testified before the special grand jury. But isn't there an exception under state law for grand jury disclosures when the interests of justice are better served?
Yes. Well, first of all, the report, the prosecutors argued, is not a grand jury report, that most of the material happened outside of the grand jury, and so therefore all of that should not be covered by any kind of grand jury secrecy, and the judge agreed. With regard to what happened in front of the grand jury, certainly there are exceptions. We were involved in a case, a very celebrated, notorious case here, the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. And in that case, there was a federal grand jury report that was made public. And after our litigation, we were able to get made public all the state grand jury testimony and all the federal grand jury testimony. So there's certainly exceptions, and they are in significant cases. And as I've said before, the 35-year torture scandal here is on a par only with or with the Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, the Black Panther murders. And those are the twin examples of incredible police and government corruption and scandal.
Absolutely.
In the city of Chicago.
Absolutely, Flint. Let me ask you, who stands to gain in Chicago from the nondisclosure, so far this 30-year cover-up of it all? Who stands to gain, and particularly, what's your view on current Mayor Richard Daley?
Well, obviously Daley would stand to gain, although I think that the special prosecutor has been careful to point the fingers in other directions. Former police superintendent Brzezek, who was specifically informed of the torture in 1982 and wrote the famous letter to Daley, which Devine, the current state's attorney, who was then first assistant, was also made aware of. I think they're going to stop there, and they're going to blame Brzezek, and somehow they're going to absolve Daley. But I think we have done enough education, and in our civil cases, we are demanding his deposition, Daley's deposition. And at key points all along the road when he was state's attorney and later when he was mayor, he, instead of investigating and instead of condemning this torture, he went along and attempted to cover it up and to minimize it and discredit it, the fact that it existed. So Daley, no matter what this report says, stands to lose, but he doesn't stand to lose as much as he should lose. The city of Chicago stands to lose a lot. They have quietly kind of tiptoed into the court and said, we support its release, but they only did that under pressure from the media. And in fact, I think they've got their fingers crossed on this one, because it's going to hurt them, because I think at the very least it's going to condemn police torture. It's going to say it was systemic here in the city of Chicago. Even if it doesn't point the fingers high enough or wide enough, it is certainly going to, unless I'm way miss my mark in predicting, it's going to be very strong in terms of condemning the police, Burge, and those who engage in the systemic torture under the watchful eyes of the police superintendents and the mayor and the prosecutors back then.
Flint, you know, I'm from Chicago. My parents were from Chicago. We used to say, in line with Lenny Bruce's observation, that Chicago was so corrupt it was thrilling. And, you know, it's just great to have you there making them pay the price for this. Keep up the good work. We wanted to sign off. Heidi and Dahlia both wanted to give you a message of solidarity. We'll keep our listeners posted. Thanks, Flint Taylor.
And Flint, we look forward to having you on again so that we can discuss the actual release of the report in the near future.
Yeah, I hope so. In my lifetime, right?
Right.
And yours, too.
Right.
Okay, great talking to you all, and it's a great show, and I'm glad to be on at any time.
Thanks,
great.
Flint.
Thanks, Flint.
Yeah. Good luck.
Bye.
Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office of Chicago talking about his case fighting police torture of over 200 African Americans in the South Side of Chicago.
Meet the king of cowboys, he rides a pale pony. He fights the bad boys, brings them to their knees. He patrols the highways from the air. He keeps the country safe from long hair.
In 2004, Amnesty International issued an exhaustive report detailing concerns about the use of tasers. At that time, over 70 people had died in the U.S. after being tasered by law enforcement agents. Amnesty International raised concern about the lack of strict guidelines governing taser use and the risk of abuse that is inherent in electroshock weapons. Amnesty International recently issued another report showing that law enforcement agents have not heeded their call to suspend the use of taser pending further study, with a few exceptions.
Ed Jackson, a former colleague at Amnesty International, is a world-renowned expert on tasers, and we're so happy to have him here with us on the show. Welcome, Ed, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you, Ed.
So, Ed, can you, for people who don't know, explain to us, what is a taser and how does it work?
A taser falls under the category of an electroshock device. There are the stun guns, which, you know, a lot of people can buy. You press them to the skin. A taser is a device that's primarily used by law enforcement. It can be used in one of two ways. It can be touched to the skin, which is referred to as the drive stun mode, or you can pull the trigger and the darts fire out. Only when the darts fire out and only when they achieve a certain spread, when the darts hit a person and there's about 12 to 14 inches in between the darts, only then does the incapacitating effect occur.
Actual darts that will shoot out from the weapon and embed themselves in a person's skin?
Well, potentially in the skin, sometimes, and they're designed to hook into clothing. Sometimes if the person's not wearing a coat or something like that, yes, they can.
But they have to do two darts at one time? I don't understand. One dart doesn't work.
No, one dart does not work.
Does this taser thing shoot two darts at the same time?
It shoots. Yes, it does.
I got it.
One of the more popular misconceptions about tasers is that any way, whenever police use them, they're using them to incapacitate a violent suspect. Well, again, in the drive stun mode, whenever an officer is touching a taser to the person's skin, there is no expectation, the manufacturer's training material say there is no expectation at all for that device to incapacitate. It's only pain compliance at that point. If an officer is standing too close to a suspect, he gets five or six inch spread between the two darts. Again, there's only 5 or 6 inches between the two darts. The likelihood of that individual becoming incapacitated greatly diminishes, and again, it becomes a pain compliance.
Well, explain how it works, Ed. It's an electrical current that shoots through, and that's the reason you need two darts, right? It's like a circle.
Right.
Right. Explain
well,
that.
The theory is, and Dahlia, one of the things I heard you saying earlier was that there really isn't enough scientific evidence on these things to tell us definitively how they actually work and the impact they have on the human body. But the way that, in theory, they're supposed to work is that the probes fire into an individual, you get the optimal spread, there's a current that runs in between the two darts, and it overrides the body's communication between the brain and the body's muscles, and you become incapacitated. You essentially just drop to the ground. Ideally, that's how it's supposed to work.
But what you're really saying, what I heard you saying, is that normally, not normally, but often, it's touched to the person's skin, and that won't incapacitate, so it's really done as a method of pain. Or if these two darts are not the 12 inches apart, if they're less, then again, it's pain but not incapacitating people. So
right.
that they can be used essentially as an instrument of whether you call it torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or simply huge pain.
Right. Well, and that's an important point of clarification I'd like to make. A lot of the times police officers are going primarily on what they've been taught about these devices. There's a huge lack of information about what these things do and how they affect people. They've been told once the taser's turned off, all of the electricity leaves the body. There's no long-term effects. So they're thinking, oh, I can shock this person a whole bunch of times, and yeah, it might hurt them a little bit, but it's not going to cause any long-term damage to them. One of the things important about doing programs like this is to let law enforcement know, hey, guys, you have wrong information. The U.S. Department of Defense, the British government, the Australian government, the Canadian government, they've all looked at these things. They haven't done studies. They've done literature reviews. They've looked at these things, and what they've all found is that, and this is a message, again, that needs to go to police, that the information that they're being given as consumers of these products is insufficient. It's incomplete. There are huge data gaps on the safety and how these things affect the human body. And police need to know that.
Well, Ed, tell us, what is the information they're given and what is the information that's being withheld? What do we need to know?
Based on the training manual that I've seen, the information that they've been given is that it's okay to shock people multiple times, that it doesn't cause any type of long-term effects or injuries, it can't impact the heart. You know, I've gone through dozens of these reports, and what they all say is essentially the same thing. If you're a healthy person and you're shocked with the taser, 1 5-second cycle, the chances of you dying are pretty low. However, if you're someone with a pre-existing heart condition, someone on drugs, a senior citizen, a child, a pregnant woman, the chances of what the U.S. Department of Defense calls unintended effects occurring, which could include permanent muscle damage, nerve damage, potentially seizures, heart damage, even death is what some of these reports saying. I'm not saying that. These reports say that. That's what's being left out. There was a report put out by the ACLU of Northern California, which was a great report that talked about how tasers are being used in California. The manufacturer put out a rebuttal report, which I've had an opportunity to look at. And again, it's all pie in the sky, singing birds and rainbows and sunshine about the safety and effectiveness of the product, when the reality is that there are some very serious risks associated with the use of this product that the manufacturer neither acknowledges on a frequent or consistent basis, and quite frankly, is setting police officers up for failure.
The position that I've seen and that I understand everybody to, or most people to be having, of tasers is that you're not saying necessarily that there is no place for tasers, that tasers cannot be used and are not at some points an appropriate law enforcement tool and actually a desirable law enforcement tool, but there needs to be more information, accurate studies done to know what really you're doing to a person when you use a taser, and that information, accurate, independent research needs
Absolutely.
To be given to law enforcement so that law enforcement knows how to use this weapon, when it's safe, when it's smart to use it, and when, more importantly, when not to use it, because we've been seeing an increase in taser-related deaths.
International human rights standards call, and there's language that specifically says, you know, calls for the development of, quote, incapacitating weapons to be used as an alternative to firearms. I seriously doubt there's a person listening to this show or a person who really has sat down and thought about this issue who thinks it's a bad idea for police officers to have another tool in their arsenal that they can reach for before their guns, before they beat someone to a pulp with their batons. This device has the potential to revolutionize law enforcement. The problem isn't tasers. The problem is the bad information that's constantly being repeated, the misinformation campaign that's being waged. There are news articles that quote the manufacturers saying, you know, they go to medical examiners and, quote, educate them about why tasers can't kill people. And then when you see the official causes of death coming out of these medical examiners' offices, they say, oh, it was a pre-existing heart condition. It was cocaine intoxication. It was excited delirium. It was all these other things. But the taser had absolutely nothing to do with it. I think that there needs to be some type of investigation into the link between the type of communications between medical examiners in these cases that involve tasers and the manufacturer, and how much information they were actually given, and whether or not the diagnoses or the decision they made is based on an independent evaluation or if it's based on public relations campaign strategy.
Yeah, I think the public relations campaign on this has actually been very successful, and people think of tasers as something that's just harmless. I was on a flight, and they had a Bravo TV on it, and there was a program on Bravo TV called Viral Video. And it was the first time I'd seen something like this. But it looked like, you know, a funny home video type show where they had a series of very funny, you know, things that happened that people had captured on video, like, you know, the bride fainting at her own wedding or, you know, people falling into a lake. They had them separated out by themes. And the next section that was police use of tasers. And the first video, I think, was a video that had been captured from a police cam that was on the police officer's car, and they stopped a woman in an SUV, and she was clearly very disturbed about being stopped, and she was talking on the cell phone, and she's talking to this
case in Florida.
Yeah, she's talking to this person, and she's saying, Mark, they're stopping me, and you know, then they open the door and they're like, ma'am, get off the phone, and she won't get off the phone. She said, they're going to arrest me. Because she's not complying with the police officer demand that she get off the phone, the police officer pulls his taser and tases her for what seems like a very long time. And she's screaming and screaming in pain. She's on the floor screaming. After he stops using the taser, he says to her, oh, come on, it's not that bad. We've all been tased. We police officers have been tased. Police officers are tased under very controlled situations.
When police officers are shot with tasers, they are in very controlled environments. They have people that can catch them and prevent them from falling. They know when the shot is going to occur.
And they're only shot for a very few seconds.
Well, initially, police officers were only shot for, you know, 1 second, 2 seconds, maybe 3 seconds. But then there was some criticism about that, so they upped it to the full 5 seconds.
But that's not necessarily how it's being used in the field.
And it's important to note, again, that tasers were designed by the manufacturer's own admission to be used as an alternative to lethal force, to be used on the most violent 2% of criminals that don't respond to traditional use of force methods with that utilized by law enforcement, pepper spray, batons, etc. When you misuse anything, when you use anything outside of its intended purpose, you're opening it up again for what the U.S. Department of Defense calls unintended effects. So when you are using a taser on a woman who's sitting in a car talking on her cell phone, who poses absolutely no threat to a police officer,
and who you know nothing about, you don't know anything about her medical history, what drugs she's on, if she's on any drugs.
Well, see, that Street Dahlia honestly kind of goes both ways. I mean, that's what law enforcement experts will tell you. That's what use of force experts will tell you.
Well, let me tell listeners, for those of you just joining us, we are talking with world-renowned taser expert Ed Jackson.
My father and my grandfather are both police officers. And when growing up, you know, my dad would say, if you get pulled over, I grew up in Houston, just outside Houston, Texas. My dad would say, if you get pulled over, there's no telling if an officer's had a bad day or whatever's going on. If he's asking you to do something and it's reasonable, just go ahead and do it, because the alternative is you could get the hell beat out of you. And I'm not saying that people should just roll over and do what police want, but the reality is we're living in a society there are more than 100,000 tasers in use by law enforcement. They have been led to believe that a shock from a taser is completely benign and that they can shock you regardless. A majority of police departments have tasers. There's something called a use of force continuum that designates what type of force an officer can use and in what situations. Tasers in most police departments at this point have been put before pepper spray, which means that after an officer yells at you and potentially grabs you, or even before the officer grabs you or puts his or her hands on you, they can shoot you with a taser.
Well, Ed, let me ask you, what would you prefer, pepper spray or a taser used on you?
I put that question in the category of a hypothetical because there are so many different variations of resisting arrest, complying with an officer, not complying with an officer, the different categories on the use of force scale. The bottom line here is that tasers should not be on the use of force continuum before pepper spray.
I mean, I think to me, one of the problems here, Ed, if I think about it and what you're saying, one of the problems here is, yes, we need something. I guess people are arguing we need something that's non-lethal, it's not a gun. The problem is, as soon as you have something that's non-lethal and not a gun, whether it's pepper spray or a taser, people are going to use that in situations where they normally would have simply picked you up off the ground for resisting arrest. But instead of that, because they have a non-lethal weapon, some cops are going to use a taser or they're going to use pepper spray because they actually have a non-lethal weapon. Now, I don't have a good idea of how to stop that, but my guess is that that happens more than it should.
Two ways to stop it. Number one is one of the things that I did when I was at Amnesty was I really did a lot of outreach to law enforcement experts. And one of the things that I heard from them over and over again is that they need our help. Because when there are bad apples in their departments, when there's a bad actor who's a police officer who's in the uniform and goes out there and does something, the entire department gets characterized based on that individual's behavior. They feel like they need to close ranks in order to protect themselves. But if we were able to kind of work with them and talk with them and have some productive dialogues and make room for them to say, okay, look, most of us are good guys, which they are, and there are some bad apples, and we don't like the bad apples any more than you do, but we want your help in getting the bad apples out of here. Starting to have those conversations, productive conversations with law enforcement, I think, is the first step. The second step is recognizing that law enforcement has been given a bad bill of sale on these devices. They have been told over and over and over again how safe these things are and how benign they are and how you can use them in any situation. There's a quote from the communications director of the primary manufacturer of these devices saying that their product is safe to use on toddlers, you know, and that in a situation, again, the reality is we're seeing that tasers are being used in situations where police would have primarily never used a gun, pepper spray, a baton, any type of force at all whatsoever.
Right. That's really the point I'm making, that what happens is you get these non-lethal weapons is they use them in situations where, it's just as you said, they wouldn't have used anything. And so the question is,
that's happening and in what situation did that occur? You know, one of the first people to train police officers on how to use this product wasn't a police officer. It wasn't a use of force expert. It wasn't anybody involved in law enforcement. It was communications director for the manufacturer.
And that's I think, part of the huge, huge problem, that we need independent research that's done, independent medical research done into the impact of tasers. And really, that benefits everybody. It benefits Taser International. It benefits police officers. And it benefits the general population.
Absolutely.
Let me ask a technical question, which I'm not sure I understand.
Okay.
When you said that they're 12 inches apart and to get the shock that'll then
incapacitate.
How do you shoot something so that it's 12 inches apart or more on a human body from some distance? How does that happen?
Under optimal situations, the product is designed, and this is where when Dahlia was talking earlier about police officers getting these exemplary shocks from the taser, in the optimal situation, the police officer can stand there, pull the trigger. When the barbs fire out of the gun, there's a trajectory that's built in so that they fire and they're designed to hit a person max within that 12 to 14, 16-inch spread when you're standing about 15 to 20 feet away is what the Brits found. You're more likely to get the incapacitating spread when a police officer is standing 15 to 20 feet away from a target. Now, you've got individuals who could be hopped up on drugs, who are running, who are not standing still like police officers are when they're shocked with tasers. So, you know, Mr. Ratner, the question that you're asking is how do you guarantee that you get that spread? The human rights community, Amnesty, civil liberties organizations need to sit down with police, need to sit down with use of force experts, need to sit down with the trainers who train the police on how to do this stuff and figure out the answer to that question. Because there isn't one, and no one is trying to figure it out. They're just told, okay, shoot the guy with the taser.
Right.
And, you know.
No, I understand that. It's a very, very good point you're making.
Yeah. And we're so happy, Ed, for you that were able here to join us on Law and Disorder. Ed Jackson, thanks so much. And we hope to have you again
in the
future.
Anytime.
For more information on taser, you can go to AmnestyUSA.org.
I have to say, you know, I appreciate what he said, and I appreciate a lot of the information about tasers. But from my point of view, it's just not something I could do, and it's not something I do in my life. Essentially, is work with cops is how to better use an implement like a taser. Some of the information I got from that you actually can't shoot the thing with any accuracy except at this particular moment the guy is standing still at 12 to 15 feet. That's number one. The other thing I guess I disagreed with, yeah, sure, there's like a lot of good cops out there and some that aren't so good. My goal is to make sure that there's cops who don't use this thing in the way, and I'm not about to go work with cops to train them to use tasers better.
That's
not
thing.
My job. My job is to sue cops when they misuse this thing and to stop them from using
it. That's right. Well, that's right. I think that's part of the problem, and we're seeing that repeated and played out again and again in different contexts. I don't think it's the job of the human rights organizations to go in and to train police officers on how to use this. Police officers should be developing, the government should be developing that capacity themselves. The government tests curling irons. The government tests your car. The government tests, you know, your blow dryer. Why are they not testing tasers, a weapon that is used on the public by police officers? At the very least, the government should be testing every single arsenal that they allow police officers to use. Inexcusable. It's not happening.
I actually don't know enough about tasers or how they feel when they hit you. But
bad.
My first reaction would be that tasers are an inhumane instrument to ever use. That would actually be my first reaction to a taser. Sure, guns are lethal, and I don't think guns should be used either. Like, they don't carry guns in the UK generally. I just wonder about the idea that of using tasers at all. Now, I do have a trouble with, of course, the argument that someone says, well, it's better than using lethal force. The only thing about lethal force that's interesting is because it's lethal, you would hope that it's almost never used. Unfortunately, that's not the experience in New York or in other cities, particularly with minority communities.
Yeah.
That's a problem. But the problem when you get something that's really bad, that probably amounts to the equivalent of torture, which is use of an electric shock like that, even if it's to incapacitate a person that amounts to torture, is it's going to be used much more routinely.
Absolutely. And I think
matter what the training.
Well, Michael, the international law, what they call for is the development of incapacitating weapons. It's not necessarily taser per se. So there are many ways to comply with international law on that and to respect the fact that we shouldn't be using weapons that kill people. I think the development of other types of weapons.
No, I think that's a good point.
Should be encouraged. And in order to make that judgment about taser that you're talking about now, we need to have independent medical research. Why is this being unleashed on the general public and given to police officers without that independent medical research?
Di, give me some sense. How many states in this country have police departments, cities have police departments that use, is this ubiquitous,
you know,
all over the country? Everybody now has tasers?
Some police departments have refused to use tasers, but tasers are, you know, they are pretty widespread. The Department of Homeland Security has actually, their two largest departments have decided not to use tasers because they said there's just not enough independent information out there. Customs and Border Control, I believe.
So it's not really a matter of training them necessarily. It's that there hasn't been the research Ed was talking about. And
well, you need two. You need the independent medical research, and then you need appropriate training and information on how to use these weapons because they're weapons.
Yeah, it just makes me in a I'm not saying that you don't have to develop a non-lethal force. It just makes me uncomfortable to talk about a non-lethal force that is so punishing to people, that is so hurtful and to people, that can be so harmful.
And it should make you uncomfortable, and I think that's the point. It should make you very uncomfortable, and we want people to be uncomfortable about using these types of weapons. We don't want them to think that these weapons can be used without any harm attached to it.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Law & Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
So as sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they fall, one and all. Ooh, the harder they come, harder they fall, one and all. Well, the oppressors are trying to keep me down, trying to drive me underground. And they think that they have got the battle won. I say forgive them, Lord, they know not what they've done. Oh.